Hello and a very warm welcome to Central Stage. Good to have you with us. Now, over the course of the last fortnight, the fierce clashes between Syrian security forces and the opposition continued without any let-up. Now, the death toll rose again and again. I think it's fair to say that the last couple of weeks were quite grim, with the exception of one happy piece of news which shows that diplomacy can still work in Syria. Welcome back. It's great to have you with us. Now, to further explore the most recent developments in Syria, two top guests join us. But for the moment, over the satellite in our Washington, D.C. studio, we're delighted to be joined by an established analyst and, of course, top speaker, Imam Muhammad Al-Asi. Welcome to Central Stage.
Thank you so very much.
Great to have you with us. Now, just a little background on Imam Muhammad Al-Asi, elected Imam of the Islamic Center of Washington, D.C. Imam Al-Asi is an established educator and writer. His publications include the first Quranic exegesis to be written originally in English. Now, time for a short break, but after the break, we'll be discussing Syria and its latest developments. So please do stay with us.
A fortnight ago, eventually one piece of good news among all the sad ones in Syria. A months-long ordeal for 48 Iranian pilgrims, in addition to the translator, ended. They arrived at the Sheraton Hotel in Damascus, welcomed by an Iranian delegation that included the Iranian ambassador to Damascus, who said the release came after efforts exerted by Iran and in cooperation with the Syrian government. The Iranian abductees said armed men moved them 17 times from one area to another in Damascus suburbs during the past several months. They expressed extreme happiness their tragedy finally came to an end. On August 4, 2012, foreign-backed insurgents kidnapped the 48 Iranians while they were traveling on a bus from the International Damascus Airport to the holy shrine of Sayyida Zainab, sister of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam in Damascus suburbs. In another development of the last week, Turkish demonstrators took to the streets of Istanbul to protest against the deployment of NATO's Patriot missiles to Turkey's 900-kilometer border with Syria. Waves of protests have taken place since the decision by NATO in November to send the missile batteries from the US, Germany, and the Netherlands, along with over 1,000 soldiers. The protesters chanted anti-US and anti-government slogans. They also called for an end to what they called imperialist powers. They say the deployment will only result in war meeting US and Israel's needs in the region. Finally, in another quite interesting development, Russia launched its largest naval exercises in decades in the Mediterranean and Black Seas near the territorial waters of Syria amid the ongoing crisis in the Arab country. The maneuvers will continue until January 29th and comprise more than 60 drills. Apart from the message that Russia is trying to send, one cannot stop considering the fact that the timing of these events are really important and at the same time quite interesting.
Hello again. It's great to have you back with us. Now, we're talking about Syria and we're going to cover the last fortnight, the last couple of weeks. Now, first, let's go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Imam Al-Asi. Now, a fortnight ago, eventually one piece of good news among all the sad ones in Syria, a months-long ordeal for 48 Iranian pilgrims, in addition to their translator, ended after efforts made by Iran and the Syrian government. Now, Imam Al-Asi, an interesting detail was that the Iranian abductees were moved 17 times from one area to another in Damascus suburbs. But I think it's fair to say that in spite of all the hostilities, there seems to be the possibility that diplomacy can still work in Syria.
Well, it's very interesting that you ask that in light of the fact that there are some news items just yesterday and today circulating that Mr. Al-Akhdar Al-Ibrahimi, who is the supposed to be the Arab League and the United Nations top diplomat in trying to put together the required diplomacy to bring about something like a ceasefire in Syria. Well, these news items are telling us that he's going to relinquish those responsibilities coming in the after time of the release of those hostages in Damascus. I have a I think a timely comment on this, and that is that if it was possible to put together speaking heads from both sides to eventually agree on the release of hostages from both sides, because in addition to the 40 odd hostages who were Iranian in Damascus, there was 2,000 plus others from the other side who were released. This should tell you and me and everyone concerned that there is enough goodwill on both sides to make things work, minus the battlefield. What is quite confusing in this context is the fact that these people who are willing to sit down and talk are not highlighted. The news is brought to us with the final result, but who are these individuals who can work these differences out without shooting at each other? I think the media here is absent. They should be highlighted and they should be prominent in that regard.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. Now I'm told that now we have the pleasure of being joined also by our other knowledgeable guests over the telephone from Tehran. Hamid Golpira, it's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much indeed. I hope you're doing quite okay as well. Now, let me just tell you that Hamid Golpira is a senior editor, reporter, and of course, writer with Tehran Times. And a large number of his articles has been translated into many languages, including Russian and German. Now, Hamid, we're talking about the latest developments, to be honest, about the developments of the last 2 weeks, the last fortnight. And with Imam Al-Asif, we just talked about the fact that in spite of all the hostilities, there was one interesting point. I mean, when it comes to the the hostages, the Iranian hostages and their eventual release, it seems that there seems to be still a space for diplomacy.
Well, to a degree, there does seem to be a space for diplomacy, but if all the sides want to use that and to be open to that, that's also a question. This is a problem if everybody wants to try to work something out or not, or be manipulated by other sides.
Let's talk about another issue which took center stage last week. Now, we know that NATO is sending Patriot missiles to Turkey's 900-kilometer border with Syria, along with over 1,000 soldiers. So that was actually a piece of news which really took center stage. Now, Turkey claims that they're only for defense purposes against what it calls a possible Syrian attack. Now, in spite of that claim, such a move by NATO has caused much outrage both inside and outside Turkey.
Asking me, yeah, it has, and there have been protests about that. There have been protests about that. The citizens of Turkey see it as a kind of militarization of their country by NATO. But at the same rate, Turkey is a member of NATO. I mean, they joined before the current government is in there. It was in, but nobody forced them to join NATO. They could also withdraw from NATO. They could also quit NATO if they wanted to, so that's up to them.
But Hamid, let me just read you a very nice, interesting quotation. Now, the Iranian Army Chief of Staff has actually warned that the missiles will lead to a large-scale conflict. Will it really?
I don't think it necessarily will. I mean, it could or it couldn't. It's not doesn't necessarily mean that's the case. There are lots of missiles around the world that don't get used, which is a good thing, but at the same rate, it could be, maybe those missiles are not for what they're saying they're for, but maybe they're for something else. But
right.
At the same rate, like I say, Turkey has to control some of these things. They should be used as a junior partner of NATO, even though they're a member or a junior member. I think, at least, that they shouldn't. And like maybe they should think about leaving NATO. If it's not going to be to their own advantage and not in their national interests.
Right. Great. Thank you very much indeed, Hamid, for that. Now, we know that Russia has actually launched its largest naval experience in decades in the Mediterranean and Black Seas near the territorial waters of Syria. And that's amid the ongoing crisis in the Arab country. Now, Imam Al-Asi, we know that the maneuvers will continue until January 29th and comprise more than 60 drills. What message is Russia trying to send, do you think?
Well, I think that Russia looks at the developments in Syria, like most nation states in the world, with the perspective of its own national interest.
Right.
Of course, the Syrian developments are playing themselves out at different levels and within different spheres. As far as Russia is concerned, Syrian developments are an ominous indicator of American penetration of a geographical area in the world that is considered, I think, by Russia to be within its, let's say, sphere of national priorities.
Right.
And the way the Syrian, because anyone who's tuned into the Syrian developments knows that this has been a war of sometimes one side seems to be winning, at other times another side seems to be winning. And I think the Russians have a keen eye on these internal developments in Syria. And they look at what is happening in Syria as far as encroaching American imperialist objectives are concerned. And just a couple of days ago, the day before yesterday and today,
right.
There's been an evacuation of Russian citizens from Syria. And that went along with the commencement of these military exercises by the Russian Navy and vessels in the Mediterranean. Add to that the other component that your previous question was about, which is the stationing of Patriot missiles
right.
in Turkey. When Russia begins to look at this, it understands that there is a measure of an offensive policy by the United States that goes beyond just Syria and threatens the southern tier of the Russian boundaries, which is the Caucasus area, Black Sea, and also Central Asia. Because remember, the Americans are militarily present in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and the Americans have 43 military bases surrounding the Islamic Republic of Iran. All of these, I think from the Russian point of view, indicates that the U.S. is on an offensive course. The U.S. has managed to recruit nation states in the area, what I would call the North-South axis, from Turkey to Jordan to Israel to Saudi Arabia to the other Gulf states. And Syria seems to be one of these areas that the United States needs in order for it to make that connection between the North, which is Turkey, and the South, which is the Arabian Peninsula. So as to break up the east-west area of influence that has been the domain of Iranian foreign policy, which aims at liberating Palestine and returning Palestinian territory to their rightful owners.
Great.
I think Russia is very much aware of this American offensive policy and is responding militarily and diplomatically in a way that sends a message to the United States that Russia is not going to countenance these types of American positions turning into hot hostilities or wars that will encroach upon Russia itself.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. Now, we're going to take a short break, but after the break, we'll be talking about the importance of timing of Russian maneuvers. So please do stay with Center Stage. Hello again. It's great to have you back with us. Now, Hamid, we were talking about the Russian maneuvers, and we mentioned that there'll be more than 60 drills, and it's one of the biggest in decades of Russian maneuvers. Previously, we talked about the Patriot missile. So what's the importance of timing in such drills, do you think?
Well, Russia pretty much wants to flex their muscles and throw their weight around and say that we are here and we have our national interests in this region as things are developing in certain ways. So basically that's what they want to say, and maybe they want to try to curtail any sudden action. Also, just to show that that they're not going to be completely complacent about any situation that might develop in the area.
But there may be an aspect to show, but considering the fact that actually Russia ordered a number of the nationals to be evacuated from Syria, do you think there's probably more than a show?
Well, I don't think it's I didn't think it's a show, but I'm not saying it could be them saying that they mean business also, that they're serious about it. It's like, so and maybe they evacuated their nationals because they think that something is dangerous now, whether they're going to do something or not. They think it's dangerous anyway.
So you're saying that it may turn out to be quite dangerous?
Well, I assume that they're assuming that it's dangerous for their citizens, and that's why they made that move.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about, last week when, or a couple of weeks ago, when Bashar al-Assad gave a key speech on the situation in the country and offered a peace initiative. Now, Hamid, 2 weeks on, how do you see the chances of success of this latest initiative?
Well, I don't know how it's going to play out, because there's also the problem that in his statement he's saying, okay, some people are in and some people are out from this dialogue which he's so wanting to have, or so-called dialogue. Well, the thing is that maybe some of the people he's saying are out, it seems, are. They might be ones that should be in, or there might be ones that have certain popular support, whether people like them or not. They might have a certain amount of popular support, and it seems that some voices are I don't know if they're going to be in or not in this so-called dialogue. I mean, there's always the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been a presence for decades and decades. Even if they were beat back years ago, they have a certain presence in Syria. So the Muslim Brotherhood are not really minor players, but somehow they're trying to sideline them, it seems. Everybody, this so-called opposition and others are all trying to sideline them, so it's a problem.
Great. Now let's go to Washington, where we're joined by Imam Alassi. Imam Alassi, we're talking there with Hamid, our other guest, about the latest peace initiative offered by Bashar al-Assad. Do you think there is anything different to that? Is there any distinguishing factor to this latest initiative?
Well, what strikes me about this latest speech by President Bashar al-Assad is that you know, there's two tracks to Syrian policy. First, the first track is the military one, and the second track is the political or diplomatic one.
Right.
Military tension in Syria is not receding. Any way you look at it, it's going from bad to worse, from month to month. But that's the military track. But when you come and look at the diplomatic track, you don't see parallel developments that are on par with the military developments. In the speech, if there were overtures to Syrians who are considered within that broad opposition, some of that opposition is American-sponsored and made. Some of that opposition is just a fanatical type component of the opposition. Some of that opposition is just opportunistic.
Right.
But some of that opposition is genuine. Mm-hmm. And some of that opposition is very sincere. Mm-hmm. If Syrian diplomacy was on par with its, if the Syrian diplomatic track was on par with its military track, it would be highlighting the sincere components of the Syrian opposition. But when you take a careful look at Syrian diplomacy and Syrian politics, you find that that's an absent element.
Right.
You don't find that the Syrian government is highlighting or trying to bring to the public to public attention the sincere elements of the opposition. So when the president of Syria comes and gives a speech and in a sense tries to extend a hand of negotiations with the opposition, in the absence of a government responding politically and diplomatically to something like that, it just seems like rhetoric for public consumption. And that's one component that was, I think, it hit me as being very obvious in that there's not much sincerity in the Syrian government trying to make amends with the sincere component. I'm not talking about agents and fifth columnists and mercenaries and the rest of these types. I'm talking about the sincere component of the Syrian opposition, which exists and which has to be highlighted in sincerity to make things work. Obviously, the opposition doesn't have that capacity. So the opposition cannot highlight the good elements, and there are good elements in the Syrian government. Mm-hmm. And I'm not speaking about the those who want to eradicate, just Allah, the Algerian experience, eradicate the opponents.
Right.
I'm not speaking about the eradicators. I'm speaking about elements there that are sincere and want to bring to closure this bloodshed inside of Syria. The opposition doesn't have the media, doesn't have the wherewithal to highlight the other side. So it takes two to tango, and the initiative falls upon the Syrian government.
Excellent. Thank you very much indeed. Now, over 30 people were killed and many injured in a car bombing in the town of Salmiya in the Syrian government of Hama on Monday. Earlier, we had the twin explosions killing over 80 people at Aleppo's university in the north. And many other reports of casualties. Now, the United Nations says 60,000 have been killed in the 22-month-old conflict. Now, Hamid, to make things worse, several massacres have also been reported. Now, these figures are already very shocking, and they're still rising.
Well, they are shocking and troubling. But it's a serious battle, serious kind of war going on. These things happen. It's not good, but that's what's happening.
Nobody's stopping it. I mean, when you talk about these figures, I mean, 60,000 probably is much easier. If you think about the figures, these are really shocking figures, aren't they?
Well, yeah, but there's 6 million dead in the Congo and nobody's talking about it, and that's quite shocking to me. It's more shocking that nobody's talking about it, but to drift off from the Congo back to Syria, you could turn your question around or your statement around. You say nobody's stopping it.
Right.
You could say, well, who was starting it? That's something else again. Like, how did this violence get out of control? Like, how did some general protests which were similar to other protests in the Arab world turn out like this? You know, and is this a manipulated situation? Are a lot of the different sides, are ones on both sides being manipulated or purposely doing things? It's like, this is a question. I mean, nobody's stopping things, but a lot of people don't want to stop it. But who was really starting things? Mm-hmm. Like where did this and how did this really begin? Is another question. You know, if it's meant to be a kind of how we say order through chaos.
Right.
You know, it looks like that to me. You know, the Freemasonic slogan. You know, out of chaos, order.
And it's taken so long, hasn't it? I mean, 22 months.
Well, it is a long time, but you know, I mean, some of these things are, some things are designed to drag on for a long time. Some things are very much designed to drag on for a long time. Mm. Sometimes they just want to create a situation, certain powers that be want to create a situation where a lot of things are destroyed and a lot of people are killed. I mean, look, here in Iran, we had an 8-year war with Iraq. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people, according to some accounts, 1 million or more people, or even 1.5 million or more,
right,
were killed in that war. It went on and on and on for this 8 years, nearly a decade. Well, that's something that, things like this, you know, they don't just happen out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
They don't happen out of the blue. Often there are forces and, you know, unseen hands and manipulating powers making things happen that when you're just looking on the surface, you don't necessarily see them.
Right, Hamid, I was saying that probably there are some designers behind the curtains designing what's happening underground.
Well, I very much think so.
Mm-hmm.
I very much think so.
So do you have any information who they really are?
Well, you know, one could speculate, say, like, I mean, part of a bigger plan on some different things going on, and not just about Syria, and not even just about Israel or something, but about a bigger world thing, you know, or the New World Order, like they say,
right.
Like little pieces, little moves on a chessboard make lead to checkmate. Okay, like something that you think is local or something is actually really, really global. Is really, really, like, this could be part of it, and I think it is. I think it is. It's part of, you know, it might be one move, you know, one move with 20 or 30 moves to go far in the future.
Right.
But it looks like it is that, than just an isolated incident, you know, or just something meant to bring down Assad by foreign powers or to prop up Israel or something like that. I think that's a really short-term view on something that, you know, like they say in this geopolitical chessboard, which was the Brzezinski phrase. Okay,
right.
In chess, you plan ahead for 10 and 20 moves ahead.
Right.
And I don't think looking at it like one or two moves ahead is going to give any kind of explanation to anything that's happening in Syria or even anywhere else in these major events.
Great. So are you saying, I think, that this is a part of an ongoing project?
Well, I believe it is, you know, and I believe in many ways, you know, in many ways it's being misinterpreted, you know, and also personally, I think like some of these things are meant to keep the Muslim Brotherhood out, you know,
right,
to keep the Muslim Brotherhood out, because you see the ascendancy of Hamas in Gaza, which is affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. You see the victory of Morsi in the Egyptian election, who came out of the Muslim Brotherhood, and groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, who have a kind of Islamic, you know, Islamic, you know, worldview. I think there's something to keep them out, and also that there's more to it than that. I could go on for a long time. We don't have such a long show to discuss all these things, but.
Mm.
But I'm sure that there's a lot of moves in the future. That if we're just trying to analyze
right.
this as if there's just it's one move on basically on one or two moves. It's not a one or two move chess game.
Excellent, thank you very much indeed for that. Now it's time for a short break. Hello again, it's great to have you back with us. Now, we're talking about the developments of the last couple of weeks in Syria, as we just saw, with the exception of one happy piece of news, all others were quite grim, unfortunately. Now, some Kurdish groups are reported to have been trying to assert control over parts of Syria through fights with rebels and government forces. Now, clashes were reported to have broken out between Kurdish militants and the Syrian army in Ramelan, a town in the northeast. Imam al-Asi, there seems to be a dangerous power vacuum, at least in some parts of Syria.
Well, that is true in the sense that the Syrian government has lost its grip on certain areas, especially the remote areas in the country, or what you may call the rural areas. Mm-hmm. And one of those areas is the one that you just mentioned, and it happens to be the northeastern corner of the Syrian Republic, an area referred to as Al-Qamishli in the general geographical sense, where the Kurdish population is concentrated. Now, the Kurdish issue inside of Syria is not peculiarly an internal Syrian issue per se.
Right.
There is that ingredient, obvious, because the Kurds are who live there are Syrians, just like all other Syrians. And may I remind the viewers that it was in the immediate outbreak of the protest movements in Syria about 22 months ago, in the couple of months after that, the Syrian government offered citizenship to these Kurdish residents of Syria who have been born there, I don't know, for living there for hundreds and hundreds of years. But the Kurdish issue actually is predominantly a Turkish issue.
Right.
And there are Kurds in Syria and in Iraq and in Iran, as everyone knows. But the concentration of this issue is Turkey. And so when a clash erupts between, let's say, rebels who are not Kurds and Kurdish citizens of Syria who are living in their own towns and hamlets, etc., in that northeastern corner of Syria, this, I would believe, has to do with the master plan of fragmenting Syria into three or four nation states. What is now, first of all, Syria, geographical Syria, is the current Arab Republic of Syria, along with Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine.
Right.
The British and the French, they came in and they split this Syrian geography into four what they call independent and sovereign nation states. Now, after Sykes-Picot and post-World War I politics and the fragmentation of geographical Syria into four nation states, now they want the major Syria, which is the Arab Republic of Syria, they want this nation state to be further fragmented along ethnic and sectarian lines.
Right.
So there are plans, these are very active plans that want to use the Kurdish issue to have a area of Syria break away from the Syrian Republic and then join the larger Kurdish concentration of people to eventually materialize in a Kurdish independent and sovereign nation state that would take its majority population out of Turkey and then with Iraq and Syria and Iran. I think this is a master plan that is one of the major components of the developments that we are witnessing unfolding in Syria.
Great.
Let me mention in this regard, when we're speaking about the Kurds, that the Kurdish issue is a Turkish national security issue.
Right.
And there are right now Kurdish groups that are proxy groups that are working to represent the war by proxy as far as the Syrian government is concerned and as far as the Turkish government is concerned. And I think the ethnic issue in Syria is miniature compared to the confessional or the sectarian issue. There's been reports, even today, news reports, that there are some of these fanatics who are attacking churches in Syria and who are attacking Shi'i Islamic centers or Husseiniyat inside of Syria. There's also reports very recently that Saudi Arabia said that it is willing to release over 1,200 of its prisoners who, according to the legal system in Saudi Arabia, deserve the death sentence. And these are Saudi Arabians, they're Egyptians, Syrians, Iraqis, Lebanese, Afghanis, Sudanese, Yemenis, etc. The Saudi Arabian government is willing to release them, provided that they go to Syria and participate in the opposition
Excellent.
And in carrying arms against the Syrian regime.
Thank you very much, Indeed, for that. Now, our last question. We have just about 2 minutes to the end of the show, Hamid. Will Syria be any different in 2013?
Definitely. It will be. I
For
don't know exactly how, but
right.
100%, but it will be. Things won't stay the same.
Right. So you can't say whether for good or for probably worse, for better or worse. You can't say.
Not exactly, but I mean, maybe some things could get better if people work for it, if there's some effort for it, if they don't get deceived, something could happen.
Great. Thank you very much, Hamid, for that. Imam Alassi, we have just 20 seconds for that last question. What's your prognosis of Syria in 2013?
Well, I think if the eradicators on both sides have it their way, Syria is going to become a much worse state. You could maybe call it a failed state along the lines of Somalia, or a fragmented state with three or four other nation states emerging. Or if the people of goodwill have it their way and they can get their act together, Syria can pull out of this, even though the odds are snowballing against this option. But there still is that glimmer of possibility that the Syrian goodwillers on both sides can pull
Great.
out of this
Okay.
and make Syria work once again.
Thank you very much indeed. So there is always a glimmer of hope. Now, sorry to end it there, but we're out of time. But before I go, I'd like to thank again my top guests. We had Hamid Golpira, top journalist and senior editor with Tehran Times. And of course, we had Imam Muhammad Al-Asi, elected Imam of the Islamic Center of Washington, D.C. As always, your insights are much appreciated. Thanks for coming on, for talking to us, and of course, for those insights. Until next week, from me, our guests today, and the rest of the team here at Center Stage, it's goodbye for now. Thanks very much indeed for watching.